Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabideau.
Good morning, good morning. And the question of the day is, why are the computers stacked up?
Ann was just asking because
here in the studio I'm recording, of course, on a laptop computer, and underneath it is another laptop computer. And there's a story that goes along with that. What do you do when you're working on the menu overseas and your computer's broken?
Right.
So we had a close call with that not too long ago.
Yes, and now we're forever with extra computers.
Because we were heading for Rome, and we were trying to make sure we could get the computer fixed before we went. And there was a question as to whether we would do that. So
guess what? I have a bigger question.
So we bought another one, and now they're sitting in a stack in the studio.
I have another question, bigger one.
Okay.
When is spring going to come?
Oh, my goodness. I really don't know. We're just so sick of snow here in Pittsburgh. Listeners, we hope where you are, you don't have as much as we did. But we broke a record in Pittsburgh for the month of February, a record that I wish we'd never even heard of.
Right.
Called the most snow ever in the month of February.
Was that prorated?
And we beat it by several inches.
No, I think it's total.
I think if it's in a leap year, you get 29 days to create a record, but it didn't matter because we made it with a couple of days to spare.
Terrible.
And we are about sick of the white stuff. Thank you very much.
But for that reason,
we're very happy that we're actually not in Pittsburgh today. We're actually in Charleston, West Virginia, where we've been enjoying Charleston Food and Wine Festival.
No, we're not in Charleston, West Virginia. We're in Charleston, South Carolina.
Oh, you dummy. Yeah, of course. We're in Charleston, South Carolina.
Who's the geographer in this
duo here? Getting my Charlestons mixed up. So we'll be reporting on who we met in Charleston very soon, as soon as we can produce that program. So watch for that in the very near future. And in the meantime, an interesting collection of guests today, each with interesting new books out. And the fascinating guy first, Chef Guy.
Who's a Twitter buddy of mine. So
He's a Twitter buddy. He's also a school teacher and a caterer and a well-trained French chef. And he decided for his first book project that he would undertake something very unusual. And let's listen to him explain the whole idea.
Chef Guy Alinat, you're a very, very charismatic chef, French-trained. And you have just written your very first book. Now, it's called The Chef's Repertoire.
Now, how do you know he's charismatic?
Just because he has
a charismatic-looking photograph.
Well, he's gorgeous, that's number one.
Okay, well, there you go.
to me, that's charismatic. And also, he and I exchange ideas on Twitter.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yes. So I know he's charismatic.
Okay, well, I hope you're blushing at that end of the telephone.
I am, yeah. You can't really see that on a podcast, but I am, yes.
Well, now, as I started to say, you wrote this book, The Chef's Repertoire, your first book. You would assume that a chef's repertoire was very large, but this is a very small book.
Yeah, and it's a very small book by design, actually. Some of your listeners who are classically trained, we probably remember French bestseller, so to speak, called Le Répertoire de la Cuisine, which was a very condensed book about the work of Escoffier. And that repertoire was intended to fit in the apron's pocket to remind chefs of all the named dishes of Auguste Escoffier and the classic French cuisine. So I wanted to do something a little similar to that.
And was it written around 1986, or was that just the first time you came across it?
No. 1986 was actually the first time I came across it. That is the year I started chef school. Le Répertoire de la Cuisine was way older than that. It's from 1914.
Okay, I thought it was. I just wanted to be sure. So it's something that basically every chef who went through apprenticeship probably got and kept in their apron, as you suggested. And then did that fall out of favor, or what happened?
He was great, you know. At the time in 1986 when I started chef school, it was all about nouvelle cuisine, but the classical French cuisine was there, and that's how we learn, you know. And actually, we still do learn the basic of classic French cuisine. And in that type of cuisine, there's a lot of different name dishes, you know, and there are like thousands of them. And it was very useful for us to take a look at that little book very quick. And, you know, it was listed alphabetically. And under, for example, some very classic sauce, like a béarnaise sauce, you would take a look at that, and in three lines only, you would have not only the origin, but also the ingredients and the technique. So that was very useful.
Now, but you've slanted this to the American kitchen, didn't you?
Yes, you know, the idea was you know, that book was so useful that before writing my book this year, I kind of wished that I had something like that. You know what I mean? Something that would remind me on the fly what is a chicken Alfredo or a Caesar salad or something a bit more complicated like minestrone or red eye gravy or turkey tetrazzini. You know, it is kind of dishes that have a name and we all know what they are, kind of. You know, but if we were going to make it right now, then we would probably need some kind of a refresher, a reminder to remind us quickly, because, you know, the chefs don't have a whole lot of time. Sure, you know, they can spend 30 minutes on the web looking at what is the essence of minestrone soup, or they can take a book like this, take a look at it alphabetically, go under minestrone soup, and in three lines, which is, you know, like a 15-second reading, oh, they know everything about it. So I thought that was great, and I wanted to do a version of international and modern cuisine. Anything that is a name dish in America today, whether you find it in a restaurant menu or on the web, is in the book. I have about close to 1,200 references. So,
how is this different from the Food Lover's Companion? I just received the 25th commemorative anniversary issue of that.
Yeah, the Food Lover's Companion is a fantastic book, you know, and it's a dictionary. That's what it is. But you have many items that are not necessarily named dishes, you know. Actually, I have one in front of me right now, and it talks about Italian parsley or Italian dressing or Italian eggplant. In my book, it's a bit different because I'm not interested in the definition of this. I'm interested in you know, the practicality of the technique, the dish. You know, I want to know. I want a reminder on how to make the dish quickly. So I want something that is practical. Sure, knowledge is great, and it's great to know everything about minestrone. But I want to know how to make it right now because I need it in my kitchen, and I need to do it now. So that's why my book is a little bit different. It's not a dictionary. It's not a guide. It's a repertoire. So,
the biggest single difference is that this one will fit into your into the pocket of your chef uniform.
Yeah, it's the
whereas you'd need if you went to La Rousse at the opposite end of the scale,
yeah,
you'd need a small truck standing by to be able to hold it.
Yeah, or you need a big pocket maybe.
who you think will be using this book? Who should get it?
Well, that's very interesting because with my fantastic publisher, American technical publisher, we spend a lot of time thinking about that. And obviously, I wanted to do something for chefs because chefs are expected to know thousands and thousands of named dishes like bouillabaisse and beef burgundy and choppino and you know, chicken Alfredo, that kind of thing. But in reality, it's very hard to remember all of these recipes. So the chefs are the primary focus here. But what we found out is that people who have some knowledge of cooking, you know, people that are in the kitchen and wants to cook, they actually love the book because it's something that is very practical. So chefs, yes, but also home chefs and also food writer and culinarians, but also front of the house people, maître d' and sommelier, who need a quick reference on how a particular name dish is wine, for example, or to explain it to clients.
Now, there isn't a similar book that you know about, because there are several books on wine, several books on wine that categorize them as pocket guides. So what makes yours unique is that it applies to the broader range of foodstuffs. I mean, I think I cook a little bit, not nearly as much as Anne from a skill standpoint, and I think both of us, as we read the book, would say, well, this is a great reminder, but I still need a recipe, whereas you're saying that chefs who've gone through apprenticeship and training and experience, what they need is a reminder because they might not have done one for a couple of years or so.
Now, you know, Peter, what's interesting is that in the book that I wrote, The Chef's Repertoire, there is actually a recipe, but if a chef takes any book from the shelf of any booksellers, if we pick up a recipe book, chefs are usually very bored with it because recipes, they spend too much time on useless details. Like, okay, you know, instead of saying sauté one onion, they're going to say, you know, take a pan that is 8 inch in diameter and put it on a burner and heat it up, put half a cup of oil, you know, and wait until it's hot, you know, and the chefs get very, very bored with it. You know, we need to go straight to the essential.
Yeah, in a medium saucepan over high heat.
Exactly, because we use a language in the kitchen, and that's a great thing, because if I'm the executive chef in a restaurant, okay, and I need my sous chef to do a certain number of tasks, I need to ask him or her very quickly. I need to ask them to do a certain number of tasks, and I need them to accomplish the task the way I want them to, you know, without checking on them every 5 minutes. Okay, so we have that language all the time, and that's the way we talk, and that's the way I wrote the book.
Okay, so you're saying the reminder would be all they'd really need.
Absolutely.
And then they'd be off and running. Now, I will admit that I would have difficulty with that, because the main reason I need a recipe is to figure out the proportions of the different ingredients.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. You know, in my book, there's no proportions. There's no, you know, I cite the ingredients. You know, not all of them, only the ingredients that make the essence of the dish. You know, then yeah. You know, because the dishes are different, right? Let's take, for example, ratatouille, you know, that you know, vegetables casserole from the south of France. There is 60 million French people in France, and there's 60 million different kind of recipes for ratatouille, you know? So there's no point in actually citing items like, you know, oregano and thyme. You know, everybody, you know, puts oregano if they like it, or thyme if they like it. Yeah. What we need to know is that what is the essence of ratatouille? What makes it? Well, what makes it really is probably, you know, olive oil, garlic, and the vegetables such as eggplant, zucchini, and tomatoes and peppers. As soon, you know, if we have that, for sure we have a ratatouille. So the other ingredients are maybe not useless, but you know, we don't necessarily need them. Now, you know, for the ratatouille, I think it's very important to go straight to the essential. You know.
And if I read one of these, it might explain it. I mean, I'm looking at fajitas. Okay, it says Mexican origin, marinate skirt steak with oil, lime juice, red pepper and garlic, grill, slice into strips, wrap in warm, soft corn tortilla, serve with grilled onions and peppers, guacamole, refried beans, salsa, or a combination of these items. Now, that's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, it is straightforward, and it leaves, you know, he doesn't overlap with the creativity of the chef, you know. The essential is there, and you just read it. I'm sure that almost everybody who's listening can understand that language. You know, it's the chef language, it's a professional language, but it's not Chinese. You know, I mean, we
right.
You know, that's something that we can understand fairly well. And as far as the quantities are concerned, the quantities are not very important. You know, except for baking. you know, obviously.
Oh, yes, right,
there's
right.
a part about, you know, about baking in the book, and there, of course, you know, it's a bit more precise, and we need a bit more precision in the list of ingredients. But really, for the ratatouille or other dishes, if you put 1 cup of eggplant less than you should, well, you know, it's not a big deal.
Yeah. Now, Chef, I'm a little confused sometimes about what all you do, because you have so many different hats. Oh, can you give us a concise, you're obviously French born and trained, and you're in Tampa, or in the Tampa area?
That's right. I'm very confused by it too, because I actually wear too many hats. I'm a chef in Tampa Bay. I was born and raised and trained as a chef in France. I came here about 11 years ago now. My first contact with the U.S. was actually in Philadelphia, not too far from Pittsburgh, right?
Oh, yeah, I used to own a restaurant in Philadelphia. Where,
oh, really?
What restaurant were you at?
That was the Bistro Saint-Tropez.
Oh, okay.
You know, on Market Street.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was 12 years ago with a great French chef called Patrice Rames. So that was my first contact with the U.S. So here in Tampa, I own a catering company, and I teach at two different places, the Art Institute of Tampa and Tarpon Springs High School. I also blog a lot, and I write this book. I think that's
enough.
So you have very little time to spare. So as a busy man, you said, well, if a chef is busy, the chef's repertoire is going to help them along, and it certainly seems like that would be true.
How about a website?
A website, yes. I have a website which is more like a blog, actually, and that is chefguy.com. So that's www.chefgui.com, chefguy.com.
Great. Okay, well, listen, this has been wonderful. I'm been dying to talk to you, as you know, because, I mean, I just, I read your 140 character tweets.
Which is, you know, and while we're talking about Twitter, you know, I would say that the chef's repertoire is actually very close to Twitter, because the you know, every entry, every recipe is really, you know, a condensed version of a recipe, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, I saw that Jeff interviewed you.
Oh, Jeff, yes.
Yeah, so I thought, boy, this ought to be a fun interview.
Well, I hope it was fun.
Oh, yes, indeed. And it's great to meet you on a voice basis as
well.
Oh,
that's fun, yes.
Well, I hope your book does very well, Chef Guy. And
Thank you. And
tweet me.
I will do that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So there you have it.
Yeah, and it's good getting to know someone in person.
Yep.
And that I've been following on Twitter.
And it's a small and very useful book. It will indeed fit into the pocket of your apron if you have one. Quite at the opposite end of the scale from a mighty tome which arrived just a few days ago at On the Menu's offices, Tom Skeller's latest book, Bouchon at Home.
No, sweetheart, it's ad hoc. Excuse me for constantly correcting you.
I'm really hopeless. It's ad hoc at home. I'm sorry, but I'm not wrong about the weight.
No, it's heavy.
This book weighs in at probably about 8 pounds, and is really quite immense. It would fit into a small handcart rather than into your chef's apron pocket.
Right.
But
don't we have to take a break?
This is a great book. Well, yes, of course we do. But I wanted to contrast Chef Guy's wonderful small book and Thomas Keller's wonderful large book, because it just seemed like an appropriate thing to do.
Okay.
So there.
And so now it's time
to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and we're going to stay on trend with our next guest. I guess I should mention first that this is the time we always ask you all to keep in touch with us. See, you can tell I've been in the South. Did you get that, y'all?
Y'all, yeah. You've been practicing your y'all.
My y'all, yeah.
For quite a time.
Yeah. But anyhow, in the city where people eat out by just all the time, just routinely eat out, our next guest took up the challenge of eating in New York City, kept a blog about it, and then turned it all into a book. And she's delightful.
She was, and it's an interesting project. And of course, if you're like we have been snowbound for the last several weeks, we've been eating in a lot anyway. And so we were on theme with this young lady too. But it's a fascinating, really dense book, all about all of the experiences that she had. I still can't believe she went dumpster diving.
Well, I know. That's the one I
just
didn't
can't figure
understand.
That out. And what do they call that? Urban foraging?
Yeah, well, that one I can believe.
Dumpster diving. The urban foraging guy, when we had him on the program, he at least wasn't picking dandelions out of the New York City sidewalk, where you have no idea what they might have been fertilized with. I mean, it just seemed a little extreme, but it's part of the story, and you'll find it's part of the interview too.
Kathy Irway, you were a phenom of our era in that you've gone from a regular life to a blogging existence to a star book author, and there was a certain vehicle for you getting there, which is also very much of our time. The fact that we're reacting to the depressed economic times and the desire or longing to get back in the kitchen and cook, eat at home. The title of your book is The Art of Eating In, How I Learned to Stop Spending and Love the Stove. Welcome, Kathy, and did you in fact do that?
I did. Thanks so much. Although I do think blogging life can be a normal life, or I don't know. We'll see.
What can be a normal life?
The blogging life, she said.
Oh, sure. Of course. I mean, everybody's blogging. Of course.
It does seem to be quite a phenomenon these days.
But it's a little bit of a move from doing a blog to writing a very dense book on the subject of why you decided to eat in rather than out. What gave you the idea?
Well, I decided to try out the opposite of what I seemed to see everybody around me doing, which was eat out all the time. And I felt like it would be, first of all, beneficial for spending, or not spending so much. And second of all, I did feel like I was getting a little tired of all the restaurant food I saw, and I felt like there has got to be a healthier, more food-aware answer to daily existence and sustenance.
We should point out that you live in. We should point out that you live in New York, which is notoriously a dine out all the time town.
It definitely is, and especially in the working 9-to-5 lifestyle, it is pretty much inseparable. You know, midday lunches are always usually eaten out rather than brought in from home.
Now,
if you can get the time away to eat, that is.
Now, this is your first book. Looking back on it, do you think it was a crazy idea to actually set forth writing a book?
I didn't really, you know, I always wanted to be a writer, so I always did want to write books, and I got very interested in food writing. So I guess I thought that it would be a very different project from my blog writing, and that's what I was hoping for it to be, because I just think that there's different values to having an actual book that you can keep, and it should have a narrative arc. Those were the kinds of ideas I wanted to keep in mind, to keep it very separate from the blog.
Yes, and it is. And I think I pointed out before we actually went on air that it's a very dense book. It's not just I've read a lot of these memoirist books with interspersed recipes, and yours is actually denser than that. It's more narrative than just brief memoirs.
Well, thank you.
So why don't we state that, I guess it's the obvious, that eating in rather than eating out is the option, but give that a dimension, because there's a whole, you have a whole chapter on the subject of what's eating in versus what's eating out.
Yeah, so I do think that there are there's a prominent lifestyle in regards to eating out all the time, and it's very different when you kind of step back, take a look at your food a little more, think about it a little more, where it came from and what it takes to bring it to your plate and how to make it, how to cook it into something really delicious. It can be a completely different experience than to eating and daily, you know, lifestyles.
So it was a total lifestyle change.
It was a bit, yeah. And having to, you know, focus on this and keep this priority, that was why I decided to do it, you know, 24/7, nonstop, rather than just kind of cook every now and then.
For two years you did this.
Yes,
two years. And you didn't just do it on your own either. You had a series of companions along the way. Matt sticks sticks in my mind, but I think there were others too.
Yeah, I didn't ask anybody else to go on this strict diet journey with me, but I did have, you know, various people in my life. My family was constant. I had quite a few friends that saw me throughout the whole thing. So it was great to have their support. And then there are, like, lots of characters that come in throughout the course of the book.
Now, tell us about some of those. I mean, you discovered things like dumpster diving and foraging, urban foraging in Prospect Park, huh?
Yes. These are great activities I learned to, you know, get involved with because I felt like I wanted to have a social atmosphere that had to do with food but wasn't in a restaurant setting. So I wanted to seek out more alternatives to cooking in a social way. So I did, you know, check out a lot of supper clubs, held a lot of potlucks, went to a lot of cook-offs, and I did want to discover even more alternative ways of getting your food, like dumpster diving, as strange as that may sound to everybody.
What did you get out of a dumpster?
I mean, it seems very strange. It seems very strange that you didn't pick up a disease in the process of doing that.
Well, check everything out, and it's really amazing how much good food is wasted. I think I read a recent article that quoted something close to 30% of all food produced in the United States is eventually wasted somehow, whether it's something we buy and we just never use up and we throw out, or it's the restaurant's waste, or it's the grocery store's waste. And just taking a look at all the waste that went into a dumpster at the end of the day for a grocery store or a bakery, it really told the whole story. I mean, you could really live off of all the waste. And it's
How did you know what you were eating?
It's just day-old bread.
You know, we worry about traceability and worried about food safety. How could you just do this by eyeballing the contents in a dumpster?
Well, if something is already wrapped and it has a sell-by date, then it is just as good as being on the shelf. A lot of times grocery stores move product just to make room for new ones, not necessarily that they went bad. If we can eat a bruised apple that's on our shelf, why not eat a bruised apple that the grocery store decided that they couldn't sell as readily as the new apples that came in?
Okay, well, let's move on then. Now, this term freegan, that blew me away a little bit. What's a freegan?
Oh, it's a play on the term free and vegan, and it's because the movement's kind of started within a vegan movement, but nowadays it's not necessarily intertwined. So it basically means using, reusing, repurposing, otherwise waste goods. So it's a resale, it's repurposed, just finding ways to use up goods that can still have some life in them and still have some purpose. So you can call, you know, picking up a couch that was on the side of the street, freegan-ing, and anything's free, really.
Okay, and now
that's the idea.
Now, right after that, you took on packaging as well and said, I don't need it packaged, so please don't put my cookie in a bag. Please don't put my apple in a bag.
Yeah, so. Yeah. It's amazing how much packaging we go through. It's actually 30% of all landfill waste is packaging. So I've seen encouraging things happening lately. People are bringing tote bags to grocery stores instead of using the plastic bags. But there is still a lot more we can do. And if we just think about whether we really need that bag for our cup of coffee, for instance, or single banana, people just automatically hand you bags for everything, it seems.
That seems to be a totally American thing. It doesn't happen nearly as much in the rest of the world. In fact, I guess a lot of places, if you want your food in bags, you take your bags with you.
That's true, and a lot of places don't have napkins that are just free for the taking either. You have to kind of have your own package of hankies or toilet paper in public, you know, toilets. A lot of the times you have to bring...
You talk about supper clubs as if they're eating in, but it's sort of a special form of eating out, really.
Yeah, it is. It's always in a home setting.
Is it a pop-up or not? Is it a pop-up?
Pop-up restaurant? Sure, you could call it that. You could call it underground eatery.
Okay.
There's a lot of kind of names for it. But basically, it's a group of people who want to put on a nice meal and invite friends and strangers and friends of strangers to the table and serve an elaborate meal that kind of resembles what you would see in a restaurant and just make it cozy and homey because it is in somebody's home. So it's a really neat phenomenon. I find it interesting because you wouldn't normally go to a restaurant by yourself and sit at the same table as other strangers, but you would here at a supper club dinner, and it makes for a very interesting social atmosphere.
Yeah, we interviewed somebody about that. Was it Freaking Forking or Forking?
Well,
Forking Fantastic.
Forking Fantastic. Yeah, we interviewed them.
Yeah.
They were wonderful.
Yeah,
those guys were on the program, and they said they were very reluctantly had to start charging for it because they realized just exactly how much of their own money they were spending.
No, you didn't tell us what you foraged.
Well, in pretty much anywhere, even in the little cracks between the sidewalks, you can find some edible greens like dandelion greens. Those weeds that everybody was taught to pick out of the lawns, those are really, really good. They're good for you. They're actually a very popular salad green these days.
Yeah, well, we use
them on restaurants. Yeah,
we forage in our backyard. I mean, I know what's in there. I mean, I don't know if I'd go to a public park.
We have plenty of dandelions in our lawn, so yeah, there's no real shortage of them.
My grandmother used to go to a local cemetery for her greens because there were so many of them for the dandelions.
That's great.
That's probably not very appetizing to mention.
Well, anyway, let's...
Just as long as you don't tell your dinner guests.
Yeah. let's hit the good old bottom line here, shall we? Because you
sure.
Conclude the book. It's very interesting. I didn't go to the end immediately, but I was interested in how you concluded. And you did 180 degrees at the end. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, I decided to do an opposite week. When I decided that 2 years are about to, you know, come around the corner, I was ready to move on, and for various reasons, but I decided to go full throttle into my first week of going back to eating in, or eating out, that is, by doing it strictly for every single meal. So every snack, every breakfast I ate was from a restaurant. And I called that opposite week, and it was a lot of fun.
No,
I didn't really know what was going to happen, but...
And what did happen? What happened?
Well, I ended up going, you know, I was, you know, catching up with a lot of friends who were very eager to show me some restaurants that I had missed out on for the past 2 years, talking about the trendy restaurants. Like, oh, you got to go there. You got to go there. I saw my parents a bit. We went to Flushing, Queens, which is just a mecca of international cuisines. So that was really exciting. And I went on a couple of dates, I guess.
You mentioned the bottom line. Now let me let you do the numbers. You also toted up the difference in cost.
Yes, I did.
Go ahead.
And well, it was a little skewed just because I ended up getting treated to a couple meals, but I ended up paying over $100 during the restaurant week. That includes a cheap fast food, takeout food, pizzas here and there throughout the week, as well as a couple nice restaurant meals. I ended up spending $25 for the normal week that I kind of tested out.
But then you corrected those numbers, right? So you imputed the value of meals that people had bought for you.
Yeah, it was around $300, wasn't it?
I think it was about $250, but it was 10 times as much as you spent.
Yeah.
Now,
it's amazing.
I'm a little puzzled about that because $25 seems like a very small amount. Was there any dumpster diving? Was there any free stuff in there? Any dumpster diving?
No, absolutely not. It was a lot of, you know, kitchen staples that I had around. I bagged big bags of rice or flour. So some eggs and some leftover sauces here and there. So I added those up too. And really what I buy each week is a good variety of fresh vegetables. So that's where most of the $25 went to.
And are you healthier? Are you healthier?
I do. Yes, I felt really healthy the whole time. It was amazing. When I think back about how I used to eat, and I still do try to eat for the most part this way, but I would eat for a snack maybe a roasted beet or a single carrot, and I would just a small amount of oil when I was sauteing something, nothing crazy. So, yeah, it was pretty healthy existence.
Well, tell us, are you on to your next project?
I am working on my next project. I'm not really sure. I do know I want to focus on growing food more.
Oh, yeah, you left that part, the urban farmer.
Yeah. Well, I did get to volunteer at a lot of farms and visit a lot of the farms over the last year, and that's become a new huge fascination of mine. So now that I feel like I've cooked everything, I want to try to grow.
Everything.
You know, go to the next level and try to grow, if not everything, as much as I can.
So there's going to be another book for sure, I guess. And in the meantime, people can follow your adventures on your blog. So why don't you give us that reference?
Sure. It's noteatingoutinnewyork.com.
Not eating out in New York. No punctuation.
That's right.
And New York is spelled out.
Yes, it is.
Great.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's actually, if you check out the URL, it's noteatingoutinny.com.
Great.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Kathy. Well, lots of luck to you.
And, thank you so much.
And this growing, we do it. And I think you'll find that it's a lot of fun.
Great. I can't wait to hear more from your show. It's been really fun.
Thanks, great. Kathy.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Have a good day.
You too. Bye. And with that, we will take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station. www.aspstation.com.
Well, here we are.
Again. we didn't say welcome back this time. We caught you. You see, you think we always say the same thing every week, but we don't.
We do.
Sometimes we don't.
Anyhow, we have a logic to this program, believe it or not.
Did we have a logic to this
program? Yes, and the logic is that if you're going to be eating in, first of all, you learn to cook with Chef Guy. Secondly, you cook in and you save a lot of money and you're much more sustainable. And if you're going to be doing all that and you still have to work and have not much time for cooking, we have the cookbook for you. It's called The Italian Slow Cooker.
Yeah, it's really a remarkable. The story behind it is really interesting. You'll find this early in the interview because it's really funny. I thought Italians cooked slowly anyway. and indeed, that's exactly what the author of this book found out. But what she also found out in addition to that, was that there are things about slow cooking that you really need to know. So you can't cook everything in the same kind of slow way. There are tips and techniques that you'll need to use to adapt your recipes to use in a slow cooking mode. And she's got all that covered with some wonderful recipes and a very enjoyable conversation that we all had together.
Michelle Ciccolone, you have written 14 Italian cookbooks.
Yes, that's right.
Which is amazing. And that does that include the current one we're going to be talking about, which is The Italian Slow Cooker?
This is actually number 15.
15.
Yeah.
The amazing thing, Michelle, when I read the book, it seems curious that you didn't get around to writing this one before.
Well, I was never a fan of slow cookers until recently, I had my moment, light bulb moment, when I was walking down the street in Rome, and I saw a fiasco of beans cooking in the window of a restaurant.
You mentioned that in the book, but it's really kind of surprising. I guess I was thinking not just of the slow cooker as a device, but of the concept that a lot of Italian cooking is indeed taken very slowly.
Yes.
And so that intersection was what happened to you when you were walking down the street in Rome.
Precisely, yes.
So complete the story.
Well, I saw those beans, and it occurred to me, oh, if only I could cook beans like that at home. Slow and gently, the water was just barely bubbling, and the beans were perfectly intact and just swelling and absorbing all the flavors of the herbs and the olive oil and the garlic and so forth. So I thought, wow, I'd love to be able to duplicate that at home, but it's hard to do unless you have a slow cooker. It occurred to me that an electric slow cooker was the equivalent of having an old-fashioned wood-burning stove with a warm place on the hearth for your beans to cook. And when I got home and I tried it, I was just blown away by how good they were. The flavor was perfect, the texture, the beans didn't get mushy, they kept their shape, and they tasted fabulous. So I started experimenting with all of the other wonderful slow-cooked Italian dishes, and I loved the result.
Now, take us through the organization, because I think you start out with soups, and then you go through. No, and you can use a slow cooker for not everything, but almost everything.
Well, there's a lot of things that it does really, really well, and there's some things it doesn't do so well. For example, soups are ideal in the slow cooker, so we have a good range of different kinds of soups, from some very simple ones like a simple chicken and vegetable soup just made with broth, ready-made broth, either your homemade or store-bought, and chicken breast and some little pasta and vegetables that you could put together really quickly and make a very simple soup. And then I have lots of wonderful vegetable soups. I particularly like the bean soups, as you could imagine, turn out great in the slow cooker. I have a wonderful one with cauliflower, pancetta, and pasta, which I think is fabulous. Another one is a zucchini soup, which is a classic summer soup.
That was funny, that one. That was odd. Tell us about that one.
Well, it's typical of the Naples area. They cook the zucchini with mint and pecorino, and it's just a delightful soup, and it's a wonderful summer soup because it's not very heavy, and it goes together in no time with just the vegetables that are available in the summer, and you add some broken spaghetti, which is very classically the way to add pasta to a soup in Italy, and it simmers all together, and it makes a delightful summer or springtime soup.
Now, I have an off-the-wall question.
Yeah?
Now, you're talking about how perfect the slow cooker is for soups.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just gave my pressure cooker, I used it once. I don't get pressure cookers anyhow. It's not much fun for me. But somebody told me that you could make a risotto in a pressure cooker.
Yes.
And it turned out that it was really rotten risotto. But I just gave that to a friend who's a cook, and he wanted it to make soups. So now, what is the difference between these soups you make fast and these soups you make slow?
Well, I'm not a pressure cooker user myself. I have used them in the past, but it's been quite a long time. But the difference is it really goes to the heart of what the slow cooker is all about. What I love about it is that I can cook on my schedule. So that means that I can put soups into, or ingredients for whatever I'm making, into the slow cooker at night and let it cook all night long if I choose. And then the next morning the soup is ready. I can put it in the refrigerator, serve it for lunch or for dinner later in the day or any time that I feel like it. That's the advantage to one of the advantages to slow cooking. And the slow cooker also makes a big batch of soup, so I always have extra that I can freeze or put in the refrigerator for another meal. And if you want to make soup or stock or anything during the summer months and you don't want to heat up your house, the slow cooker is a great way to do that because it doesn't really use a lot of energy, and it doesn't create a lot of heat in your kitchen, so it's very energy efficient and makes it an ideal way to cook things that would typically take a lot of time. Let's say if you wanted to make a big batch of beans to use for salad, and it's the weather's really hot, it's a great way to do it.
Do you ever work with that Rancho Gordo guy with all those heirloom beans?
I've tried some of them, and they are excellent, I must say. I was very pleased with the results that I got from his beans.
Yeah, well, the ones I want, they seem to always be out of. I've never figured
that
out.
Oh, that's too bad. I had received a gift of some and really enjoyed them.
Now, Let me ask another question here, Michelle. Let's suppose that you have a slow cooker and you're energized by the whole concept of slow cooking, and you think you have a recipe that would work, but you're not sure. I'm guessing that what you started out with was recipes that you cooked in some other kind of cooking method.
That's right.
And then you tried them in the slow cooker and you adapted them because the slow cooker did certain things differently.
That's right.
I mean, can people do the same with their recipes? And if so, what are the adaptations that need to be made?
You could certainly adapt recipes to the slow cooker. The primary adaptation, I think, is that you will need less liquid in the slow cooker, because with the slow cooker, you don't have evaporation happening. The cooker seals in the covers are airtight, and so you should not have a lot of steam escaping, and therefore you can start with less liquid in the cooker than you would use in a typical recipe. And so that's one thing to keep in mind. And also you'll find that foods come out wetter, juicier. So if you've made a stew, for example, and there's a lot of liquid around the meat or the chicken, whatever you've cooked, you might need to cook it down a little bit. And you could do that either on the stovetop or just remove the cover and let that evaporation occur and let it cook a little bit longer in the slow cooker.
Now, I think you also mentioned something about layering things. So was it vegetables went at the bottom and meat came on top?
Yes, that's a very good point, if you have, like, potatoes and carrots in your stew, it's a good idea to put them into the pot first, so that way they will cook more evenly. They have a better chance of cooking through if they're on the bottom of the pot.
There you go. Any other? I mean, those are two sort of really sound ones.
You did figure out risotto in this.
Yes, I did do risotto in the slow cooker. It turns out to be a very soft, very creamy risotto.
Yeah, right.
And what I think it's really excellent for is if, let's say, you're serving, I don't know, steak or veal scallopini, and you want to serve risotto as a side dish with that. But, of course, your steak or your scallopini will take a lot of attention that you can't devote to the risotto cooked the typical way. So if you want to serve risotto as a side dish, I think the slow cooker is ideal for that, because you can have it cooking while your attention is diverted elsewhere. And a lot of people like that very soft, very creamy texture.
Yeah, I mean, you either like it or you don't like it. I mean, I sort of tend towards preferring the a little bit drier.
And we made it in the pressure cooker, and we only made it once. I think we ate a couple of spoonfuls, and then I think we threw it out.
Oh, that's too bad.
It was so good, we threw it out.
Oh, my goodness. I would have tried turning it into risotto al salto. Maybe that would have worked. Have you ever done that?
No, what is that?
No, please.
Well, it's a classic Milanese preparation, and whenever you have some leftover risotto, do give it a try. You let it chill until it congeals and it turns into a lump, and then you shape the lump into patties, and you can, if you like, you can bread them, but it isn't even necessary. You could dust them with a little flour and saute them in butter in the skillet, and they turn out crispy on the outside, and you don't mind the creamy soft texture on the inside so much.
That's interesting.
It's a great, and you could put a salad on top and serve it for a wonderful lunch dish, or serve it with eggs, or I love that. It's a really nice preparation.
Now, Michelle, a little bit about your background, because it's really interesting. You're a cooking teacher.
That's right.
And you're also an Italian culinary tour guide.
That's right.
Does that mean you take groups to to Italy?
Yes.
And what's your favorite area to tour for food?
My goodness, I love the Naples area. I really do.
That's from the south?
Yes, my family is all from, in fact, the Naples area of Italy. Mm-hmm. And so I really enjoy going there, the Amalfi Coast, the city of Naples.
Beautiful.
Very exciting. And all around that area, there's so much wonderful food and good seafood, and the vegetables are just outstanding. So I'd say that's my favorite.
Oh. Well, I wanted to just mention that actually, in addition to having all the information anybody needs about slow cooking, your recipes themselves are very good, very interesting. Tell us also about if you've done
this is your 15th cookbook. How did you get onto the Sopranos thing?
Well, they contacted me. I was contacted by HBO and asked if I was I a fan of the show and would I like to write a cookbook with them. And I was not a fan of the show at that point. I had never even seen it, and it was a complete mystery to me. So I boned up on it and decided that it could be a very fun and interesting experience, and that's really what it turned out to be.
So one's called The Sopranos Family Cookbook, and
right.
The other one's called Entertaining with the Sopranos.
That's right, yeah, and they were huge sellers. You know, the first one especially was number one on the New York Times
bestseller. I mean, are these serious cookbooks, or did you just have fun with that theme?
No, they are serious cookbooks. The recipes are recipes that I adapted from my family. One of the reasons why I think David Chase chose me, he was the producer, the creator of The Sopranos, was because my family came from the same part of Italy as his family did. David Chase's family is from the Naples area also. And when we spoke about dishes that I imagine that The Sopranos would typically eat, the family would be cooking, then I spoke about food that I had grown up with and that my grandma used to make. And so the recipes are absolutely authentically Italian-American and from that region of Italy.
Well, anyhow, listeners, it's called The Italian Slow Cooker, and probably you'll get hooked not only on a slow cooker and some of these wonderful recipes, but also on the author herself, and you can explore all her other cookbooks. Now, we've talked a lot about soups, but I feel like we have a void here because we didn't mention what you consider to be an essential part of the book, and that is meats. And then what I consider to be the most surprising part of the book, which is desserts. Give us a rundown on meat cooking in the slow cooker and what desserts you make.
Well, I think the slow cooker is really, really comes into its own when it comes to meats, because you can really take advantage of very economical cuts like shanks and shoulder and ribs and things like that. Meats that take a long time to cook, they really just become fall off the bone tender, and it's they're very they really come out at their best when they're cooked
and without being dried out.
Exactly. They never dries out in the slow cooker. It's really the perfect way to cook all of these economical cuts that I think people are focusing on nowadays. And then as far as the desserts are concerned, well, that was just a fun idea. I thought, I have a small kitchen, and I thought, I only have one oven, so what if I was cooking a turkey or something that was going to take quite a long time in my regular oven? How would I cook my cheesecake for dessert? And so I tried cooking it in the slow cooker, and it turned out just perfectly tender and creamy. The cheesecake never browned because the low, gentle heat of the slow cooker is perfect for cakes such as a cheesecake. I also do a wonderful chocolate truffle cake, which is creamy and smooth and absolutely delicious. And there are lots of other desserts, too. Poached fruit comes out great in it.
Pumpkin cake with tipsy raisins looks good.
Yeah, that's a wonderful, kind of like a pudding cake almost. It comes out rather dense, but very satisfying. It's a really nice snack cake and great with a hot cup of coffee on a cold day.
You could probably do your sister's plum pudding in one of these.
I don't know.
I think that would be ideal.
I won't go there. I don't have any idea.
Okay. Well, again, Michelle, it's full of revelations, this book. I never thought there was so much to know about a slow cooker, but there certainly is, and thank you for telling us about it.
Thank you, Ann. My pleasure.
Well, you know, we've been talking about the Charleston Food and Wine Festival. I'm sure everybody knows by now that the next thing to expect is that we will be putting the interviews that we've had during the festival into programs for the future. And so you'll be able to listen to all the chefs that we met and talked to.
Yeah, so if you missed the festival, we're so sad. You would have had a good time. You must put it on your calendar again for next year.
This was the fifth annual.
Is it five now?
Yeah.
It's become very successful, and lots and lots of great chefs from around the country come there. And, of course, we caught up with them as many as we could, so be sure to tune in to next week's program, maybe even the week after that, to find out what was cooking there. a look into the future too. A couple of things coming up that are fun. We are in the next few weeks headed for the wine country of Paso Robles in California, midway between San Francisco and Los Angeles, a place we haven't been to before, but about which we've heard great things. And mark your calendar for the dates of, I think it's May 26th through 29th, or 25th through 29th, for the New Orleans Food and Wine Experience.
Now I'm going to have to do some heavy lifting and running before we go to that one.
Otherwise known as NAUFI. So we're working on an announcement for NAUFI very soon. We're in touch with the organizers of the festival. They're assuring us that we'll have a wonderful time. They've been doing that for 19 years. But this will be the first time we've been there. So we'll be headed for one of our favorite cities to eat and drink in, and we'll eat and drink to excess.
Oh, dear, dear, dear.
And while we're on the subject of New Orleans, let's hear it for the Saints. We all hope that, like you, or like us, you thought it was a wonderful thing that they won, a wonderful thing for the city. So go Saints. Saints Super Bowl champion sounds like a contradiction in terms, but they are it at last.
Yes.
And that's all we have for this week. So until next week, same time, same place.
Bye-bye.